Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, February 12th, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are colleagues Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, ex-Missouri football star Michael Sam makes headlines around the globe after telling ESPN and the New York Times he's gay. The Olympic Games are underway in Sochi, Russia, and some of NBC's coverage is coming into question. We'll talk about what's being edited and why. And there are some new names in news this week as Glenn Greenwald's new venture takes flight and former New York Times executive editor Bill Keller announces he's leaving to head the nonprofit Marshall Project. But first, let's talk about some announcements a little closer to home. Yesterday, a big one here at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Starting in fall 2015, the Journalism School will offer a degree program in documentary film, thanks to a $6.7 million gift from alum Jonathan Murray. The writer, producer, and pioneer of reality television is best known for developing the MTV series The Real World and Road Rules, among others.
I always hope that with documentaries, that it starts a conversation, that it makes people think about something in a way maybe they haven't thought about it. So I'm very excited that at the University of Missouri we'll be training people to be documentarians and that they will be telling stories that will open our minds and make us think about things maybe the way we haven't thought about them before. I think the documentary is just an essential part of a democracy. And I'm excited that that's going to happen here.
Now we have the means of being able to bring the right players together in the right way in the right place to truly impact the entire world's viewpoint and approach to and use of documentary journalism. So this plows new ground for this J School.
That second voice you heard there belongs to the university's new chancellor, R. Bowen Lofton. How big of a deal is this for our school?
I think it's pretty big. I mean, it's an opportunity for us to go from, I wouldn't say 0 to 60, more like maybe 35 to 75, because we have done some really interesting things in terms of the intellectual academic side with documentaries. But this is a chance for us to actually build on an area where we don't have any real strength, any real muscle in terms of training people to be documentarians. But we have the True False Film Festival that's obviously established itself here in town, and they're going to be greatly involved with it. We know that, especially with the opportunity to do documentaries online now, that there's a whole new audience for this kind of long-form storytelling. And I know, just from personal experience, that we have a lot of students who are quite interested in the opportunity.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the big key, especially as this takes off, is that the number of students that it's going to draw. I mean, the Journalism School has done a really good job of getting students involved in all aspects of journalism. And here's another opportunity to expand that in a way that we weren't able to do before.
So what might this program look like as it starts to come together?
Obviously, we don't know for sure because we're not directly involved in the planning of it. But by 2015, the fall of 2015, supposed to start out with an undergraduate degree program, followed at some point thereafter with a master's degree in documentary production. But all of the real important questions in terms of the curriculum, how broadly are we going to define documentaries? How involved are people from other parts of campus going to be in the program? How do we deal with this notion of balance or fairness or objectivity as opposed to the documentary style, which is really based on point of view? There's a lot of things that still have to be decided.
Yeah, I think that's the key in terms of building the curriculum is, are we going to stretch the Missouri method in a way that hasn't been done probably since we went to the convergence model and brought that in? So you're looking at another way in which journalism is going to be practiced, or already is being practiced, and it has multiple outlets, as Mike said. I mean, it's not just on television. It's in theaters and it's online.
So you actually bring a really good point up there and something I wanted to touch on. One of the commitments that our school has had going back decades, you mentioned the creation of the convergence department interest areas, which Mike and I are faculty members, but our school has always had this commitment to change and looking for new technologies and new things to bring into the journalism education.
I think that, you know, we're going to continue to do that. And with the help of alums who have branched out in areas that aren't necessarily journalism. They got their start there, but they went in another area, but they still have a connection to what they did here in journalism. And that helps to further that change. And it also helps in creating more of an interdisciplinary type of environment here in the J School and on campus.
And it probably goes without saying, but it's a lot easier to dive in and do this well when you have a committed alum who's giving us $6.7 million. That money will be invested and we'll live off the interest of that, but that will be enough money to hire faculty, to develop programs and summer workshops. And I mean, it really is an opportunity to ramp up to full speed pretty quickly.
Okay, well, this isn't the only change coming to the School of Journalism this week. Last Thursday, we came back to campus after the snow days to learn that the dean, Dean Mills, will be retiring effective August 31st. He's currently the longest-serving dean on campus, having been in the position for 25 years. During that time, we've seen the launch of the Reynolds Journalism Institute, the creation of 8 new endowed chairs, the building or renovation of 4 of our J-School buildings, the development of the online editions of the Missourian, KBIA, KOMU, Vox, and Global Journalist, the birth of an online master's program. I could go on. There's no question Dean Mills is going to be leaving quite a legacy behind here.
Well, so first of all, if I'm going to talk about Dean Mills, I have to say several caveats. One, despite my boyish looks, I was here and was on the search committee when he was hired 25 years ago. He's been my boss and has promoted me 3 different times. So take all of that with a grain of salt. But as you say, he clearly has developed a long legacy, and part of that is because he's been here for so long. Deans don't typically, in this day and age, last in most academic posts for more than 5-10 years. Being here for 25 years, you can accomplish a lot. You can take the snapshot of what the leadership of campus and the university wants, and you can work with that, and he's done that very, very well. He's also, as you said, reached out with some help from some other folks to bring the Reynolds Journalism Institute here and do a lot of things that are going to make it both easy for the next dean, I mean, walking into a really good situation, but also there are going to be lots of comparisons, and it's going to be hard to live up to someone who in 25 years did a lot of stuff for the school.
Yeah, I've known Dean for 20 years when I came here as a master's student, and he brought me back 11 years ago as a faculty member, and I really appreciate the fact that he saw in me an opportunity. He saw that, you know, I could help the program grow. I agree with Mike. The next person coming in is going to face, you know, some challenges, and those challenges center around how do you grow the program in different areas. I mean, we just got through talking about the documentary journalism program. Well, that's one area. There are others that are out there. So it's going to be a challenge for the next dean to build in the way that Dean built, because they're going to be comparisons.
Yeah, and in my experience, very much like yours, knowing Dean as a student when I was a student here, and knowing that I had his faith in coming back and he welcomed me as a faculty member in doing that. Dean is retiring from this position, but he isn't leaving exactly. Mike, tell us a little bit about what's going to be coming next for him.
He's going to be working part-time for RJI, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. One of the things that we do each year is bring in visiting fellows. They might be from industry or academia or from our own faculty, and they work on projects. And he, Dean Mills, is going to be supervising that for a while to help us firm up how we appeal to folks to get the best fellows here, how we support them when they are here. So he'll be doing that work for a while. You know, one other thing I wanted to say, Amy, before we got off the subject, one of the things that Dean said in the interviews that he gave, and I'm glad he said it because I think it rings true, it is time to bring in some fresh blood, some new perspectives, because there's so much change going on in the media right now. When he was hired, he was 43 years old, and that's the kind of, I hope, I mean, I don't have anything to do with the search right now, but I do hope that we are looking for somebody who is going to have that kind of youthful both enthusiasm and knowledge of how digital media works when we get our next dean.
Okay, well, we'll be watching for that over the course of the next few months. Sunday night, I was watching Downton Abbey when I noticed my Twitter start to blow up. It's because the New York Times and ESPN had released a story reporting former MU football player Michael Sam had come out as gay.
It was not difficult for me to come out to my team. Everyone was just like, shook their heads, just like, finally, Michael Sam came out. And then it was very supporting. And it was like, I was kind of nervous. I was like, man, I'm actually doing it. But saying it and just how everyone's reaction was so like awesome. And I just like, these are my teammates. These are my brothers. I can play for these guys. I'm coming out because I want to own my truth. I'm comfortable who I am. And I didn't want anyone to break a story that without me telling it. And I want to tell it the way I want to tell it.
Word spread like wildfire. Mizzou administrators, players, fans, and celebrities tweeted their support. Even President Obama weighed in, saying Sam was showing real sportsmanship, leading the way. This isn't the first time that we've seen the story of an athlete coming out. Why is it that this one seemed to resonate so loudly?
This one resonates because Michael Sam has the potential to be the first openly gay player in the NFL. Most players have that have come out usually do it toward the end of their career or after they're out. He's going to be going into the NFL as an openly gay player, and that's what that's what's causing the story to sort of blow up, as you say. And part of that is now they're starting to have a conversation about NFL locker rooms and whether or not a gay man can be accepted into an NFL locker room, or is he even going to be drafted? And if so, where? So it's a larger conversation that I think needs to be had.
Sam said, and we heard it in the audio just there, that he wanted to be able to control how this story came out. He wanted to be the one to be able to tell it and control that message. Was he successful in doing that?
I mean, it's amazing how he and his team were able to control it. I mean, he let his teammates know back in the summer. And there was some talk about whether or not he was going to reveal that he was gay then. He decided not to because he didn't want all the focus to be on him but on the team during the season. Other media, including the Columbia Missourian, knew about it but decided it wasn't their job to out him. And so, but there are other media, I'm quite confident, once they learned of it, that would have been willing to do so. So the fact that he was able to control the message and come out on his own terms more or less over that many months is just amazing.
Well, I think it really shows where we've come as a country, where you can announce that, you can tell that to a group of people that you feel really close to, and they themselves say, hey, it's not my place to tell the world about my friend. That's his responsibility. And, you know, that's a huge step forward, because in the past, I mean, that story would have gotten out, you know, and it would have been on the air. Somebody would have picked it up. Newspaper would have ran it. Broadcast stations would have ran it. But, you know, it didn't happen. Not in this case anymore.
One of the things we've talked about recently is how stories like this are treated by the media. What was it? Not even a month ago, we were talking about a story in Grantland that had issues of outing somebody who was trans. Are we getting better at this as reporters, as journalists, as an industry, or is this a different situation entirely?
I mean, I think every story is a little bit different. Mm-hmm. In this instance, I mean, he had supportive teammates, people in the local media here who could have done something differently and didn't. Frankly, I think it really came to a head when we had some of the folks, the scouts, the NFL people, who were starting to talk about it as he was playing in one of the, I think, the Senior Bowl or whatever it was, and were coming up on the combine where they're going to be best testing their skills against each other. And it was starting to leak out among the professionals. And so I think what happened here in Columbia, you know, there's a lot to be said positively about that. But in some other ways, I think the reaction within the league and among sports people, there's still some room to grow.
So let's talk more about that for a second. And Ernest, I see that you're wanting to say something, but there is a story that is on our blog that people can go ahead and read that was in Sports Illustrated on its website Sunday night that was relying on a number of anonymous sources, different scouts, different locker room personnel within NFL teams. And their reaction wasn't as positive, that this could become a distraction, that locker rooms maybe aren't ready. Those stories all relied on anonymous sources. Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, you know, that doesn't surprise me. It doesn't surprise me that you had people out there saying that. It doesn't surprise me that they didn't want their names used. They didn't want to be identified, because that places a stigma on them. But I think that journalists need to sort of push a little bit harder to get these sources to identify themselves. Because if you have one side that's basically saying, hey, you know, I'm gay, all my friends are okay with it. There are others within the NFL that are okay with it, both players as well as executives. But then you've got these executives over here that are saying it's going to be an issue. But they don't want to say who they are. I have a problem with journalists not pushing that envelope to make those sources say, hey, you know, stand behind your words.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we don't know who those eight people were. And I think they were cowardly for not putting their names in front of their comments. I actually think Sports Illustrated was a bit cowardly in allowing them to be anonymous. I mean, there are some NFL, officials, executives who are perfectly okay with this. We saw John Elway quoted, yesterday, who's a manager, as we know, for the Denver Broncos. He said, you know, I'd consider him drafting him depending on, you know, how he performs in the combine and what we need. So we have no idea what the, quote, average team executive or people in the locker rooms really feel about this. So giving that kind of anonymity was just kind of, to me, it was a cheap shot.
I agree.
One more thing I want to bring up about this. Mike, you and I had some conversations before putting today's program together about how university officials in the athletic department reacted over the course of the last few days. And it's been very different than what we've seen in recent weeks about the athletic department speaking out on national stories.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I suppose you could be skeptical about the fact that the university was being whipsawed from all the really negative coverage of the Sasha Minucori story, you know, the swimmer who committed suicide. And there's all this question about what the curators are going to do about this at their meetings here later this week. And so this was an opportunity to get a really more positive story. And it wouldn't have been a more positive story probably 5 years ago, but society has changed so much that this really is a positive story for the university. And it's okay to talk about that, but I think it's okay to just say our team and our athletic department responded in a really fantastic way toward Michael Sam. And so why shouldn't we be getting some credit for that and talking about it? Look at that amazing image that some folks did in the snow in the stadium the other day, putting the S and A in front of the big Rock M. I mean, that is just a spontaneous, really cool reaction to a story that is light years different from what it would have been 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost through the first week of competition in Sochi. It started with an endless stream of tweets from journalists arriving in town to find hotels still under construction, rooms that didn't have locks on the doors, toilets that weren't hooked up to any plumbing. The list goes on. Well, watching the NBC broadcast, it looks like everything's okay. The athletes appear to be smiling, and they report their accommodations are just fine. They're thrilled to be there and want to compete. Friday night's opening ceremonies, which were replayed on a 10-hour tape delay, had what some are calling some pretty key moments edited out here in the United States. Here's some of that.
Yes, it is possible, even as competitors, to live together under one roof in harmony with tolerance and without any form of discrimination for whatever reason. Yes, it is possible, even as competitors, to listen, to understand, and give an example for a peaceful society.
So that was about 30 seconds of a 4.5-minute excerpt of IOC President Thomas Bach's statement on tolerance during the Olympic Games that NBC chose not to air during its primetime broadcast. Why might they have chosen to cut that out?
Well, I think that, NBC said that they were doing it because of time limitations and that sort of thing. But there's been this huge controversy about the anti-discrimination laws in Russia and whether or not those laws are going to be enforced in Sochi during the games and, you know, how that was going to play out. And I think that, you know, I could be wrong, and NBC said they didn't do this, but to take that out sort of opens NBC up to the criticism that they're getting, that you're censoring. You're taking that out as not to cause any problems with your Russian hosts.
There were lots of things in that speech, just from a journalistic perspective, if you have to limit the time that you might cut. I'm just amazed that they cut that part. I mean, they had 10 hours to make the decision. I don't know if they had his remarks in advance, but they probably did. And, you know, when you look at what Olympic officials typically do and their mealy-mouthed reaction to various controversies, that's just about as direct and indirect statement about tolerance as you're ever going to hear from them. So if anything in that speech was newsworthy, that was.
Right, right. And above everything else, I mean, yes, you have NBC is putting on this the Olympic Games, the sports, this performance, but they also have their news crews there. And those news crews are actually covering stories. This is a story. It should have been covered. It should have been on.
Have you been watching much of the actual games themselves?
A bit, and I feel sorry as a broadcast colleague, so to speak, for NBC. I mean, you know, everything that could go wrong for them has gone wrong. I mean, you had Shaun White lose yesterday after all the buildup from that. You really don't have any figure skaters whose names are particularly well known. You don't have any speed skaters. You got Apollo Antonona, who's on the other side of the microphone now.
Lindsey Vonn
wasn't even participating. Yeah. So, you know, it's pretty much of a downer so far for the Americans.
And the other issue is the storms that have been plaguing the country. I mean, more people are concerned about the ice and snow in the South and the other storms that are coming through the Midwest and going up the East Coast. I mean, people are sort of so entrenched in thinking about their day-to-day that the Sochi Olympics is sort of like an afterthought.
And then if it couldn't gotten any worse, Bob Costas gets an eye infection and he can't be on the air.
That's where I wanted to go next with this. So to add insult to injury, Bob Costas contracts this eye infection, and Matt Lauer takes over the helm last night of the primetime broadcast. Is this the potential for the changing of the guard for the Olympics, or is this just a guy who got sick and got sidelined for a few days?
I think this is a guy that got sick and got sidelined for a few days. I mean, there's something about when you're presenting the Olympics, there's something about stability.
Okay.
I mean, I remember, was it Claude McKay?
Jim McKay,
who was on the Olympics forever when ABC was producing it, and everyone expected him to be there in primetime, the same way with Costas.
I mean, Matt Lauer did a fine job last night. I watched part of it, and, you know, this probably helps him a little bit in terms of softening up his image after the whole Ann Curry debacle, so good for him. But, you know, there's really no comparison between him and Bob Costas as a sports anchor, so I'm sure Costas will be back soon.
I'll admit, I've always been more of a summer Olympics person than winter. But one thing that I'm noticing, and maybe this is a summer thing versus winter, but there doesn't seem to be as much programming as there has been in the past. I know I've gone to MSNBC or CNBC or USA looking for some of the other events that might be going on, and it's not there. It's almost as if you get your couple of hours in the evening on NBC on primetime, and that's kind of it.
I think a lot of that came from the last time they had the Winter Olympics, and you had this sort of time delay. And what they were finding was that people want to watch it live. And if they can't watch it live, they'll pick it up online, or they'll hear about it as they're watching SportsCenter. And once they know who won and who lost, it's sort of like, well, why am I watching? I think that has a lot to do with it.
And now they've got all these folks, even more than 4 years ago, who have smartphones that are getting alerts all the time. And if you don't program your alerts really carefully, like I keep forgetting to do, I'm getting spoiled even when I don't want to be spoiled.
While we just had this discussion, I stopped myself from giving a spoiler. So I don't know if people will appreciate that or not. We've been talking since Glenn Greenwald left The Guardian about the news organization he was going to be starting up with the financial backing of eBay founder Pierre Omidyar. It went live Monday with two investigations. What do we see in this launch of The Intercept?
Well, I think one of the things that you see is that this is a change in journalism. And it's been coming for a while where you're going to be able to get investigative journalism from sites that are outside the mainstream media, New York Times, Washington Post. I mean, those organizations are still going to do it, but you have these others. And the other difference is that they have an agenda, and they tell you up front what that agenda is going to be. But I think one of the issues that they're going to have to deal with is funding, and whether or not that they're going to have the funding to sustain this for a long period of time, because most of their reporters are freelancers. They're independent contractors, and they're negotiating their contracts. Well, you know, when you have that kind of situation, funding is fluid.
I mean, I good for them that they're launching this. And what's interesting to me is it isn't just one product that they're putting out there. So Omidyar's company is going to have multiple digital magazines plus an overall overarching website that aggregates this content. So they're going for multiple audiences, multiple revenue streams. Their likelihood of success is greater than somebody just pouring, you know, a few billion dollars into one operation. So I think that they have a chance. I don't have any particular reaction to their launch because mm-hmm. a lot of what they're doing the first, you know, few weeks is going to be based on the stuff that they've already gathered, NSA, yeah, Snowden stuff.
And I'm kind of wondering what's going to happen when that plays out. What are you going to have after that story sort of plays out? I mean, where are you going to go in terms of getting news and information that people are going to be interested in?
They always say the hardest thing about a launch is having content to go after your first show, your second show, after you've run those first.
But given
stories.
As much credibility as they've built up and impact that they've had with the NSA Snowden stories, I mean, there are lots of folks who might be inclined to leak or provide more information to them as a result.
That's true.
Well, Bill Keller also announced he's going to be leaving the New York Times to head up a nonprofit journalism startup called the Marshall Project. It's going to focus on the American criminal justice system. So maybe. What do you think? Could this be the start of the rebirth of journalism, or maybe we do need more reporting within traditional news organizations?
I mean, I'm happy to see more focus on criminal justice reporting. I mean, I think as they described in some of the promotion of Keller going over to this, that the American justice system has quite a few warts, and they need to be exposed. And it's not clear that the media do an in-depth job of exposing them all the time. So, I mean, I think that's a good thing.
I think if they're able to get those stories to a wider audience, it could have some impact. But I think they're going to have to take it much larger than that, because the criminal justice system is influenced by social policy and by economics. And if you don't touch on those issues as well as what's going on in the criminal justice system, then you're going to have very little impact that's going to be meaningful to people who have to deal with that, with the system on a daily basis.
I just hope they can come somewhere between sort of a law journal style of writing and Nancy Grace and come somewhere in between that's entertaining, but that's more in-depth and informative.
And less sensational.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, let's touch very quickly on an about face we saw from management at AOL last week. Tim Armstrong announced the company would be changing how it allocated 401k matching funds that would match at the end of the year instead of during each pay period, which meant if an employee left mid-year, they'd miss out on that money. But the way Armstrong explained it to employees during a conference call, it sounded like he was blaming the change on the Affordable Care Act and two babies. In an effort to illustrate how the company still cared for its workers, he cited examples of how it had paid, quote, above and beyond $2 million, what was necessary, for the care of two women who gave birth to babies and needed extended care. An example of really bad communication here.
I think it was bad PR. I mean, I think someone in this PR department should have gotten him and said, whoa, wait a minute, that's not going to work. That's going to hurt our image. But I think what he's facing, what a lot of other employers, large employers are facing, and that is that you have, now that we've switched over to this 401k plan, you have a lot of people who are expecting that at the time of retirement, mm-hmm. and they want as many benefits as they can get from that. But you have companies that are also basically trying to save money. So there's a disconnect there.
I think they've also got a Tim Armstrong problem. He had the same similar public relation issue with Patch. And if it hadn't been for one of the moms of those two babies coming out and writing about it in Slate, he might not have changed his mind. So they need to look at the top.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we're just about out of time for today. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today. Check out our links blog. You can find it under the talk shows tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @views on KBIA. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Josie Herrera is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when Ernest, Mike, and I are back with you for another edition of Views of the News.